On ABC Radio,
this is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Ahoy there, welcome aboard. It's The Big Fish, and we're really into accessible fishing here on The Fish. We've got hundreds of kilometres of estuary shoreline up and down the New South Wales coast, where the fish come up onto the flats, particularly at low light, particularly at high tide, and the fishing options there are limitless. But you've got to get the right gear, and you can do it wading, or you can do it in a little kayak or a little boat, but it's very accessible and it's great fun, and you never know when you're going to tangle with that meter-long flathead or catch a 40-centimetre brim or a 40-centimetre whiting. And it's just great sport, but it's a part of the estuary that's often not accessed by a lot of people. I introduced my young bloke, Harry, to it, and he's fallen in love with it. We'll get his view next, and we'll get Trenno's thoughts on hard bodies and soft plastics and surface and just subsurface lures in that very skinny water around the edges of the estuaries and the mangroves between the seagrass and the shore for you as our first cast on The Big Fish. Coming up. Harry, take us through the session.
Yeah, so we went out on the flats, just on the high tide, and we chucked the hard body pro lures out on the 4-pound line, and the big brim were just smashing them. It was a great fight. Something really big bit me off. I think it was a big tailor, a big brim, and yeah, it was great fun. It was great fun.
We don't have an electric motor. How did you get around?
I was standing up on the front, just casting, and Dad was rowing me around, keeping me in the hot spot.
Yeah, the manual electric motor. And conditions have been good for it.
You need a bit of wind to get a good distance on the cast, because they're really light, so they don't throw too far. So you got to throw with the wind, and that gives you the best chance to catch a good brim.
You've caught plenty of brim on soft plastics. Hard bodies now are another option, but it's pretty niche, isn't it? You do it at certain environments, certain times.
Yes, yeah. Well, normally we catch the big brim on the live bait, but no, it's definitely good fun catching them on the hard bodies. You also give yourself the chance to catch some good flatties as well. Also, even the other day, went out and caught a nice whiting on the hard bodies.
That was a beautiful fish. Fried that up for you. Yeah, that's a real bonus, catching a beautiful big whiting. Well, thanks for sharing your adventures. I really enjoyed putting you on the spot, mate.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for rowing me around.
That's all right. I think a lot of people would think you need these very expensive electric motors, but just a 10-foot tinny and a pair of oars, and you can have a bit of fun, can't you?
Yes, yeah, definitely.
All right, tight lines, mate. Thanks for joining us on The Big Fish.
No worries. Thanks, Dad.
See ya. It's The Big Fish, and there's Harry, who's been introduced to a new style of fishing out of the boat, and great out of the kayak too, finesse fishing with extra shallow running crankbaits, tiny little lures on gossamer thin line around the 3-point-something centimetres long. They're very light, very little, deadly in 10 centimetres of water up to about half a metre to a metre. And what they do is open up massive expanses of our estuaries, places where the fish feed on the high tide and the right light conditions. They come in droves, particularly the brim, but you'll get the whiting, you'll get the flathead. And surprising how many other species will grab these little tiny lures as well. But there's a real trick to fishing them, really light line or braid. And Trenno is a great exponent of luring brim. Good morning, Trenno.
Morning, Scotty. How are we, mate?
Yeah, that's as good as it gets. And it's interesting how I've gone, and Harry's sort of following in the dad's footsteps, gone to these little ones that go under the surface, because I got a bit of RSI of the elbow through using the surface baits, doing the walk the dog. And I think the hookup rate is much better with those little ones that just go under the surface. For me, anyway, I know you love your surface lures. It's so much fun, isn't it?
It is, mate. And I'm also a big fan, as you would have heard over the years, of the bent minnows, mate, I reckon, because they can be a surface, can be subsurface, get down about, you know, a foot or two, but they're deadly as well on brim, flathead. I have caught whiting on them before, but, yeah, they sort of brim and bass love them, so, yeah.
Yeah, they're a bit exy, though, aren't they, the good Japanese ones? You're looking at 30 bucks plus and
40
bucks plus. And when a big flathead comes up and swims away with it in its gob or a tail, it chops it off, you're crying. Whereas these little ones, you can get them for around $14 to $17, a little chubby crank baits. I think even those Finnish gurus, Rapala, make one that goes all right. Their hooks are a bit heavier. I like the little ones on the Pro Lure XS crankbait. They're really sharp. They will bend quite easily in the fish's mouths, particularly the big brim, but boy, they stick, don't they?
Yeah, they do, mate. Look, you've got quite a few cranks, and without going into names and all the rest, and I, you got the crank 38s. You've also got, like, Rapala have they're a mid, they're one, if I was to use a hard body for brim, mate, the little Rapalas, they have a mid-crank there that gets down about six foot or so. The other ones, there's another little chubby lure that you can use, and they only get down about 1 or 2 feet, and they're not too bad. As I said, my favourite would be the bent minnow. I've gone right into my plastics as well, mate. I love those little two and a half inch wriggle tail plastics. There's a couple of different brands out on the market that sell them, and I use them on a really, really light jig head. The other one I do like, and that's becoming a really fast coming, becoming a favourite of mine, is the old crabs that you can buy.
They're great.
And one, or you get the little, the hard body ones. They hurt when you lose those.
Yes.
Three and four casts to monster flathead.
Aren't they brilliant? Aren't they brilliant design, though, the way those little tiny sharp trebles are hidden in the claws of the crab, and what does a crab do when it's in a defensive posture? It sits on the bottom and it sticks its claws up in the air, and that's what the brim pick at straight away, and they get pinned there, and you don't do anything with those. You just throw them out in front and wait, don't you?
That's correct. And there's a few soft plastics out around now that actually emulate that same thing, but a bit cheaper to throw. You got to use different jig heads and different techniques with them, and assist hooks on them. But I use those as well, and I'm fine with them. If I'm starting to lose too much on there, if I lose more than two or three in a session, I usually put straight over to the plastics. And a little bit slower to come on them, but I still get good fish on them.
But we're talking about from the roots of the mangroves out to the seagrass. We're talking about those large expanses of sand and mud and flats that the fish move up onto in the high tide, and most people ignore. They're in the channels, they're in the deeper water. So we're talking about lures that present well in 10 centimetres and, as you say, go about 30 centimetres under the water max. They're the ones that you use in this scenario. And, of course, surface poppers work great, don't get me wrong. They're fantastic, but I don't think they have the same hookup rate. But there are tricks, aren't they, too? One of them is not really lifting too hard on them, just winding them on, cranking them on, you know, doing a sort of pointing the rod and hooking them without pulling it out of their mouth.
That's correct. That's those things there. The other thing you got to remember, too, if you're fishing that really shallow water, is you got to have a rod with the line or braided line that you can cast at least 15 to 20 metres away from your boat, or if you're walking the flats. Because I know when I'm walking the flats and I'm out in the, up to my knees in water, I know that I have to cast a lot further to get the whiting up. They won't come in too close to you.
That's right. You need
sort of spook. So you've got to be able to have a good cast on you.
Absolutely. And that's where having a bit of breeze does actually help you, doesn't it? You can fire that gossamer thin, really light gel spun or braid or mono. Mono works all right. Up into the air. We use 4 pounds straight through mono fluorocarbon and just fire it up into the air. And you'll see the lure land, and then the line will land about 10 seconds later as it slowly drops down like spider web. And you can really get it way out there, fine and far off, as they say. And, it's deadly, but it's stealthy fishing. It's visual fishing. You need your Polaroids, don't you, Trenno?
Definitely, mate, definitely. And, of course, you don't see the brim. All you see is a flash and then your rod buckles over and you're on. And same as whiting, you don't see whiting unless you're on the surface. That's the only time you'll see them take. But, yeah, I'm a bit partial to up and amongst the mangroves. You know, you get up and amongst all that up in there with the little floating cicadas and patterns, little fizzy lures like that. They're surface, but your subsurface, really lightly weighted plastic. Same thing with the crabs. If they don't want to come up too far, if they die, you know, you look for a bit of shade, get it up in there, and they have a go at them as well.
You know, this is great for the kayak fishers, and it's safe for the kids too because they're fishing that country. If you want to have a rest from your back, you just step out and stand up. You know, it's quite easy. And we've got a little 10-foot boat. So I was rowing Harry around last night and just putting him onto the fish. And he just had a whale of a time. It was so good. So I was the manual electric motor. The manual electric motor holding into the wind. But it's awesome fun. It really is. And I think really that sort of water gets overlooked by a lot of fishos who go to the deep holes, go to the channels, go to the snags, whatever. But there are miles and miles and miles of those sand flats and mud flats and mangroves and seagrass beds around the edges of our estuaries where a lot of people don't fish, Trenno.
No, that's correct, mate. And like I said, they don't get the attention that they should. There's a few blokes get up on the flats there, and they're chasing the big girl flathead with the bigger lures and that sort of thing. But not a lot of them get up there and actually throw 3 and 2 and 3 and 4 pound around for your brim, your whiting, and that sort of stuff.
No, and then the big girl flathead comes up and buffs it. I do love the way flathead take those shallow running lures and those surface lures, particularly if they're in about half a metre of water, and you tend to find them in about 45 to 50 centimetres of water when you're doing this style of fishing. They don't necessarily nose right up to the bank. At night time, they do. You know, you'll see their lies right up against the shore because they use the mangroves or the shoreline as a net, basically. That's where they know that the prawns, the little fish, can't go any further, so they've got them trapped,
right,
and they just snaffle them down. Yeah, but, you know, they all seem to take the same sort of attack. That lure will come over the top and they'll go straight up and hit it like an Exocet missile, fly out of the water and then come down in a perfect arc, arching their tail in this perfect swallow dive. And it's just so exciting. And off they go. They tend to go hard in that sort of environment too, don't they, Trenno? Sometimes they come up out of the 3 metres of water or so quite docile until they have a run near the boat. But in that sort of water, they sprint across the top.
They do, mate. They roost the tail of the line, and all you see is the hissing of the water and the singing of the drag, mate.
Exactly right. Now it's really, really good fun, and you can do it on your feet, as you say. If you've got an estuary where you can access those places on foot, you can walk the sand flats. Just watch out for stingrays, of course. Shuffle your feet and broken bottles. But if you can't access it that way, you can certainly access it by kayak or little boat, tiny little boat. I find too on the kayak a really good tip is to cut down a bit of an old gum tree, like an old walking stick, you know, a piece of wood, tie it, sharpen one end, tie it to the side of the kayak, and when you get to a good spot, drive that into the bottom as your anchoring point, and then you can fan your cast out with the wind and then move on and have a, you know, anchor yourself up at another spot. That is a little tip that works quite well, Trenno.
That's correct, mate. They call them poor man power winches.
that's right, indeed. Well, I was
poor
the
man power poles. That's right. Yeah,
yeah. And those little lures. I mean, they've got virtually a flat bib that just go under the surface. Do you sell many of those in the tackle shop, Trenno, or people are more into the deeper?
It's a sort of a seasonal thing, so that'll be more full on summer. You sort of sell those along with your poppers because, you know, it's the surface in the shallow water is a lot better in those summer months when the water gets really warm up there. The deeper divers, we sell a lot of those through winter. So you're getting down your 10 to 12 to 16 to 20 feet, depending on which one you buy. And they're more for the winter fish because they usually school up down and big schools down on the bottom there and the deeper holes and that sort of thing when they're getting ready to do a spawn run, yeah.
And why are those bent back minnows, which Bushy swears by too? I had a session on Mallacoota with him, and it was unreal the way that those giant black brim would wolf that down off the top or just under. You could see it really clearly from the boat with the Polaroids, you know, and then you could throw it a long way with the wind. And the more wind, right, he was happier, the bigger the wave, the better the fishing across the sand flats in Mallacoota. But why are they so expensive? I mean, what is in them? And they're made in Japan, aren't they?
They are made in Japan. Anything out of Japan is not cheap because they're made with quality and care. That's what I put it down to. And if you can't read the back of it, it must be good.
Yeah, they make some great little tiny soft plastics too, don't they, for a little tiny jig head. But I think a lot of people don't do this because you are using very, very fine line, not because you're being sporting, but it's the only way you can get distance off a little, 2,000 reel or below to get it out there.
Yeah, no, that's right, mate. You need that ultralight gear. And like around the mangroves a bit different, but you're up on the flats. There's nothing there really to.
No. Loosen the drag, and just let them go. Treno, they can't do you on anything, can they?
No, that's right, Ariel. Let them go.
It's great, great sport. But it was great to introduce the young bloke to it last night, and he really loved it. It's very addictive, isn't it? That sort of fishing.
It is, mate, and you know how much I like my brim spinning and my bass spinning. So, yeah, I'm sort of really, 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 really into it. So,
yeah. It's hunting, isn't it? You use your eyes and you're in a nice spot. I like that part of the estuary too, and I think that part of the estuary supports a lot of food and a lot of fish that we don't realise are there unless you go in. And people with bigger boats really miss out on it, I think.
Yeah, well, they get bigger boats for a reason, so they can go outside and all the rest of it. I'd rather stay inside. I think my offshore days are gone.
Yeah.
I prefer estuary and lakes.
I agree with you, Treno. Anyway, it's good fun luring brim and whatever else will grab a hard body lure, a little soft plastic. Those tiny little soft plastics, what sort of jig heads are we talking about? Because they'd have to be pretty light, wouldn't they?
Yeah, mate. I've always said with brim, you finesse them, so anything around that 1/32nd weight or 1/20th or I think there's even a 1/40th now. And it just looks like a jig head, just like a hook there with a tiny bit of lead on it. And that's about it, mate. So, but something around that size there, mate, yep, that is what I tend to use. I use right up to about I think the heaviest jig head I've got in my brim bag is 1/8.
Use those tiny little ones. You can also put on some of those skipping prawns and use a really small jig head and actually keep them on the top. The whiting and brim go ballistic for those, and you're fishing them out of the water more than in the water.
That's right. I actually use, I take the leads off like a weedless hook, and I use them up and around the mangroves because they're just like a chin lock or something like that, just a bit of lead on the front, and get them down weedless so you don't snag up all the time. That makes it even better.
Yeah, that's good fun. It's not for everyone, though, I think, Treno. It's finesse. It's a bit finicky because the line's so light. You will lose lures. You will lose fish. A lot of people aren't prepared to go down to line of, 3 or 4 pound, but that's basically what you've got to do. And you've also got to find the really light gear, really thin rods that are quite whippy and long. It's not for everybody. I mean, most people would find that a little bit too finicky, too hard, but for the people who are into it, the purists, it's terrific.
Mate, I absolutely love it. I tend to do more lure fishing now than I did before. I don't do much in the way of baits. The only thing I use baits now is if I'm on the beach for a mulloway or a tailor. And that's slowly starting to change too, because I'm finding that most of the lures that I get, I've actually built a new rod that I can spin on the beach for, things like Taylor and Dew. So I'm introducing that a bit more.
Yeah, so you're a bit, well, Stinker went off the bait for 1 week, but you've definitely gone off the bait pretty permanently. Although if I'm looking for a feed, I still, the live worms, the live nippers and out on the flats, on dusk or dawn, and that's where I will get a good feed, because you're not worried about the big fish swallowing it down. But the good thing about using the lures on the flats is as you hook them in the mouth and just a little pair of pliers and click, click, and they're gone. They don't even feel it.
No, that's right. And like I said, it makes it it's a lighter and easier bag to carry than a bucket with bait and all the rest of it that goes with it. So yep. I find it a bit easier, mate. Yeah.
Yeah. Good fun. Trenno, tight lines. Thanks for talking about hard bodies for Brim. And you know, if anyone's qualified to talk about hard bodies, it's Mr. Puniverse there, Trenno. No, only Jake. Oh, only joking. How can I talk, eh? Glass houses and all that and stones.
Yeah, don't throw stones, mate. I tell you what, right. You'll get yours in a couple of weeks' time, mate.
Yeah, we're going to target the bass. We're going up to one of the big rivers of the North Coast, and we're going to do a bit of fly fishing. It's fly versus lure. So I think Trenno's already got it in the bag. I might need a handicap.
You've got him. He's in the boat with you.
Tight lines, buddy.
See you, mate.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
I'm on the 437 out of Central, and I'm heading north. I've had this ticket for my destination since the day I was born. I'm on the 437 in a boxcar like a hobo on the run. And if today is the first day of the rest of my life, then let it roll. 'Cause I'm moving up to the fishing town, where rubber boots and the flannel shirts are handed down. I'm moving up on the fishing tide, as far as I can tell, the city is just some crowded shanty town. I'm on the 437 stowed away. There ain't no window seat. There's a fella playing solitaire, and he bets against himself and then he cheats. There's another guy who's got his eye on a piece of pie, but she's just a photograph. It seems that everybody's dreaming the dream of how to get what they need. And I'm moving up to the fishing town, where our boots and the flannel shirts are handed down. And I'm moving up in the fishing line, where people get together and have themselves a really good hold down. I'm on the 437 out of Central, and I'm heading north. And I've had this ticket for my destination since the day I was born. I'm on the 437 in a boxcar like a hobo on the run. I'm on the 437 out of Central, heading for Easy Street. And I'm moving up to the fishing town, where our boots and the flannel shirts are handed down. I'm moving up on the fishing tide, as far as I can tell, the city is far behind. I'm moving up to the fishing town, where people get together and the world slow down. I'm moving up in the fishing line, where people get together and have themselves a really
time. Good time.
We're gonna have a good time. I'm moving up to the fishing town.
I'm moving up.
I'm moving
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
G'day, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott.
Stinky, you've had an adventure with 50 crew on board and no mutiny. Is that right?
No, we were a happy crew. You've got to keep the crew happy, you know. You don't want to, that's the last thing you want, is a mutiny. But what we did, and oh, gee, I enjoyed it. It was midweek, and we jumped on the old ferry, the old Tea Garden ferry, which has got a magnificent history, and we putted across the port and tied up in front of the pub over in Tea Garden. And 50 people jumped on board, and then we went back down the Myall River into the port, and then we motored right around the port from Yacabar Head, which is North Head, then straight across to Tomaree on the south side, then back right back around and up to Soldiers Point and back to Tea Garden. What a great trip. I enjoyed every second of it.
And there's a lot more water to explore, Stinker. That's just sort of the front end of the estuary, isn't it?
Well, that is. That's the East Harbour. And the West Harbour goes from Soldiers Point to Karua and up into the Karua River and as far up the Karua River as you want to go, which goes a long, long way up as far as Allworth. We don't go up that far, but we just do like, Lemon Tree Passage and Tanilba and Swan Bay. There's so much to see, and Carrington and Tarlee up in the harbour. It's and the history, and that's what really excites me. Apart from the fishing, the history really excites me. And I've mentioned before that I'm really driving hard with others to establish a regional museum, a Port Stephens regional museum, which we hope will be established on Tomaree Head. But the things you learn. Because I've always been interested in old sailing boats coming into Port Stephens. And the first one was the Salamander. And it sailed in 1791. Now, the Salamander was part, is an old whaler. And it was part of the Third Fleet. So it come here bringing convicts and whatever else. And it was the first ship, sailing ship, to enter the harbour. And I often think what the Worimi, the Aboriginal people, would have thought when they saw this great thing sail through the heads. They'd be absolutely astounded, I think, maybe even afraid. But so that was the first visit. But later, another boat, the Providence, a couple of years later, under the captaincy of Broughton, Captain Broughton, sailed in through the heads, and it went further up into the port. And what it was astounded to find at Soldiers Point, which is probably 4 or 5 kilometres from the port, was four escaped convicts. There were five, but one had passed away. But there were four escaped convicts who were living with the Aboriginal people at Soldiers Point. Well, they were pretty pleased to go back to Sydney, I think. The history just keeps unfolding, Scott.
Just amazing, isn't it? And that huge expanse of water, I mean, to get those giant sailing ships up into there, they must have seen the potential.
Oh, look, yeah, if you're travelling north from Sydney, it's the most logical place to go and take a rest. But there's another a real trivia question for all of our listeners, and this is a beauty, you know. What has Gold Coast bikinis got to do with Captain Broughton, who was on that original ship? And of course, Broughton Island was named after him. Cook either named everything, Captain Cook ever named everything after himself or his mates. So Broughton is the island 8 nautical miles north of the port. But getting back to this question, which is a real teaser, what's a bikini on the Gold Coast got to do with Captain Broughton?
Gee whiz, I don't know. Is that what he wore under his kit? Was he I don't know. What's the connection?
I'll put you out of your misery. In 1920, a lady was born by the name of Paula Stafford. Now, other people will start to think, I think I know Paula Stafford. Now, Paula Stafford grew up in her later years around the 60s. She was on the Gold Coast, and she designed and introduced bikinis to the Gold Coast. Well, you still might ask, so what? Well, Paula's middle name was Broughton. She was Paula Broughton Stafford, and she is a direct descendant of Captain Broughton, who sailed on the Providence into Port Stephens and gave his name to Broughton Island.
That's amazing. That's such an interesting link. And we won't have bikinis on, but we'll have a swim because it's the only island off the coast with beautiful beaches, and we're heading there next week, Stinker.
I'm looking forward to it, Scott. I always do. You've got to watch the sea, of course. That determines whether you go or whether you don't go. So at the moment, things are looking fine. So hopefully next week sometime, you and I might land on that island and have a bit of a fish and an expedition. And there's so much to find out. Even if you don't go fishing, Broughton Island has got so many questions. So many questions. I mean, going back to even the very, very earliest days, I was part of an archaeological dig. And what was found by the archaeologists on Broughton Island relating to the Worimi people was unbelievable. The amount of evidence, it's irrefutable that the Aboriginal people were there in numbers, and they left a lot of evidence behind, which really thinks it's just magnificent. I get quite excited by all that sort of stuff. But in 1906, the French were there, and it was their challenge. They introduced rabbits to Broughton Island, and it was their challenge, a Dr. Danzig from Paris, who was the nephew of Louis Pasteur. I mean, how big's this story going to be? And he actually, Danzig, it was his job to discover something that would eradicate rabbits, not only on Broughton Island, but then could be introduced to the mainland, because the rabbits on the mainland were causing all sorts of problems for the pastoralists. They were eating all their grass, basically. Well, by November 1906, the French gave up and left the islands, but the rabbits stayed and thrived until not so long ago, when National Park said enough's enough and actually got rid of all the rabbits and did a great job doing so. And since, the vegetation has jumped back, the birds have jumped back, and it's just a beautiful place to visit.
And the rats as well, Stinker. They were running everywhere, weren't they?
Yep, rats were tap dancing on the roof. And cockroaches were racing around in circles. And it wasn't the nicest of places. All that has been cleaned up. And it's their biggest problem now is, and it's a National Parks and Wildlife problem, is prickly pear. And that's pretty much out of control. And it's a hard thing to control. And bittu bush, well, bittu really hasn't taken over Broughton yet, but it has at Fingal Island. Bittu bush has just choked everything. So we've got a few issues here. Apart from it being a beautiful place, we do have a few problems.
Yeah, but all in all, it's pretty good. And I know they've got the Cactoblastis moth to try to control that. They use those incredible sniffing dogs, didn't they, to help with the eradication of the rats and the rabbits, to great effect. They're so clever, those dogs, and brilliant work done. When you saw when it was infested, when we went there years ago, you would think, how could they get on top of this problem? But they did.
They certainly did. And now there's a frog over there, a green frog, and he shouldn't be there. Now, don't ask me how he got there. I have no idea. But he shouldn't be there because he's not indigenous to the island. So National Parks, it's an ongoing battle to make sure that everything on the island was indigenous to the island in the first place. And green frogs aren't welcome. So if there's any listening this morning, I'd suggest you don't go to Broughton Island.
No, no, don't take them for a ride. They may have stowed away with someone. Of course, they've got the really rare and beautiful green and gold bell frogs that do live there, don't they? That they're amazing.
That's correct. And I think you'll find that it's one of the most naturally occurring colonies of that particular frog in Australia. Have a check that one out. But
no, I think you're right. And the reason they're thriving there is because the chytrid fungus that's killing frogs worldwide, they're so close to the ocean there in their pools and their freshwater springs that they get a little touch of salt. And that little bit of salt water sort of bathes them and keeps them healthy from the fungus. It's like you, Stink. It's why your body's so lively. You're in the salt water every day. Nothing can grow on you.
Well, I'd like to be as have much life in me of those frogs. I'd be jumping about.
Because those ponds over the backside of the island are just loaded with the big tadpoles, aren't they? And the green and gold bell frogs are doing really, really well there.
They are. And as you say, it's brackish water, and the salt, when the big seas come up, they lash right up into the ponds. So it's not fresh water at all. It's quite, and it's a stagnant, I mean, you wouldn't think anything could live in it, but these particular frogs thrive in it, and it's their perfect habitat. But that's just another twist. I mean, there are so many other birds on the island. I don't know how many birds, different types of birds have been counted, but also, what also intrigues me, are the shapes, the geological shapes, and how they came to be. I mean, I look at it and think, how on earth did that happen? You know, I mean, I've got a reasonable understanding of geology, but not to be able to explain these certain shapes. So when you put it all together, and of course then the Chinese were there, the Greeks were over there, the Italians were there in the 1890s. They've all left, of course, and there's very little evidence of any of those people on the island. So it's an adventure. It's a real adventure, but it's a good idea to learn about it before you go, so that everything sort of makes a little bit more sense. That's the whole idea. Get something, read something, find out what actually happened there, and then go over and have a look. It's just something that you really need to do.
And as a bonus, we might even catch a snapper or two, Stinker.
Yes, look, we'll think about that when everything else has been covered. But the snapper over there waiting. I mean, I made friends with a few last time I was there, so I'll go and catch them next time.
Right. Well, even if we don't catch any fish, it's such a great trip. It's so good to get out to sea, weather permitting. We'll be in the bigger boat, Stink Bug, which has got a few feet on Stink Pot. I wouldn't try to get there in Stink Pot.
Well, I have taken Stink Pot over there, 11-footer, but I cheated a bit because I put it on the deck of a trawler. And the trawler was going up the Seal Rocks, and it pulled up in Esmeralda Cove and lowered Stink Pot into the water. And then I jumped in Stink Pot, and then I stayed on the island for 3 or 4 days. And then when the trawler come back, they gave me a toot. I went out and they lifted up the boat, put it on the deck, and back we went to Nelson Bay. But I wouldn't be taking the whole 8 nautical miles in Stink Pot, I can guarantee you that.
Looking forward to it, mate. I was thinking, you know, you really travel light too. You've got your pill bottle full of hooks and leads in your pocket. You've got your rod, and that's about it. And I was thinking of Captain Cook when he hit the reef and they had to throw all this stuff overboard. You said to me, travel light, Scott. One rod, a change of clothes, a change of underwear, and that'll do you. So maybe you'll have to throw a bit of my stuff out before we set sail.
Well, hopefully we won't run up on the reef, Scott.
No, that's always a chance, but we can both swim. Hey, tight line, Stinker. I'm really, really excited about next week. We'll bring back some fish and hopefully some good stories for our big fish listeners.
Oh, that'll be guaranteed. Hooroo, Scott.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Family were whinging, Dad, you let yourself go. They hardly ever visit, so how would they know? Because I choose to live in a caravan park. They think I've lost the plot, but they're way off the mark. My waterfront view only costs 200 a week, and old Millard is my mansion. It's cozy and doesn't leak. There's brim at me back door, I catch enough to eat. I go prawning and crabbing up the mangrove creek. The kids shake their heads, they reckon they know best. Dad, you should be in a nursing home, you can't live like this. The Riverside Holiday Park is not their cup of tea. An old Millard and a tinny, that'll do me. They reckon I got no social life, but that's far from true. This filthy Phil and Neb, the happy hour crew. Cold beers under the fig tree, prawns in the ice tub. On Friday we get the courtesy bus to the raffles at the club. They look down their noses, they think I'm trailer trash, because I clean the toilets to make some extra cash. They said, what if you get sick and need medical attention? I said, you can call me an ambulance, it's covered in me pension. The kids shake their heads, they reckon they know best. Dad, you should be in a nursing home, you can't live like this. The Riverside Holiday Park is not their cup of tea. An old Millard and a tinny, that'll do me. When the time comes, I finally have to go. Just slide me into the river, tie a crap pot of me toes. There'll be no need for sadness, no need to grieve. Just check me next morning, the muddies are on me. The kids shake their heads, they reckon they know best. Dad, you should be in a nursing home, you can't live like this. The Riverside Holiday Park is not their cup of tea. An old Millard and a tinny, that'll do me. An old Millard and a tinny, that'll do me.
It's the Big Fish, and from our Northwestern Tamworth chapter of Oz Fish Unlimited, Anne Mitchie joins us. Good morning, Anne.
Morning, Scott.
Anne, you've got some good news and some bad news. I guess we'll start with the bad news so we can leave our Big Fish listeners with some happy news at the end.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yes, there is a bit of sad news here at Keepit and on the Namoi just below Keepit. Unfortunately, we've just had a fish kill, which is just astounding considering that Keepit Dam itself is sitting at 100% capacity. We've had good rains. The rivers have been flowing. But through some poor water management, the water's got turned off too quickly coming out of the dam. We've got poor water quality and stranded fish, and they've unfortunately perished.
It's a shame, Anne, isn't it, if they were koalas or furry and fluffy things, gliders, which we do love too, but because they're native fish, which is just as important as any other creature in our landscape, it's so sad. People don't seem to have the same care, but there's a simple fix to that, isn't there?
Well, yeah, definitely, Scott. There is a simple fix with the management of our rivers. And, I mean, it's just a shame that Water New South Wales sometimes aren't listening as well as they could be about when you turn a delivery tap off, if you could just turn it off slowly, not all at once, so that the fish have got time to move downstream or get into deeper holes and adjust to the fact that there's not big flows in the river at the moment. Just like with nature, when it stops raining and then things drain down, it slows down and trickles down gradually. It doesn't just, you know, bang, it's going and bang, it's stopped, rivers. So when we regulate them, interfere with them, we've got to get better at trying to replicate a natural drawdown or runoff.
Hard for them to do, eh?
No, not hard at all. Just as I said, don't turn it off all at once. Turn it off slowly. And I mean, I fully understand that with delivery of water, they've got to send it in blocks so that the water will get to the desired endpoint without a lot of transmission losses, they call it, so evaporation and losses in, back into the water tables through the rivers. You want it to go down in fairly hefty blocks. So the fish, if you think about it, can put up pretty easily with the water getting turned on rather quickly. That doesn't worry them too much. You know, a big fresh coming down the river, it's just when it stops all of a sudden without a bit of a drawdown that it becomes problematic for them.
Now, if I recall, I think maybe the last time we crossed to you live in that part of the world, you were on the Namoi, just below the dam, planting 600 different native grass species and ground
grasses
covers
and trees and
to repair
this is, this is the exact stretch of the river we're talking about. Unfortunately, Scott. So yeah, just see where we were, where we've been working. It was just upstream is where we found some beautiful big cod floating belly up in the river.
And it's sad because they migrate such long distances. You were saying you'd found out about a travelling cod there in the New England that had packed his or her bag and gone on a big holiday.
So 900 Ks. There's some research just came out recently. And, this cod, they're tagged down in the Murrumbidgee or somewhere, I think I want to say. Yeah, they come up into the lower in the Murray, come up into the Darling. Anyhow, so it's done 900 Ks, this little fish. They reckon they hang out at home when they're only babies. Sound a bit like humans. Hang out at home when they're only little ones. But then when they get a bit more adventurous and want to go and find a friend or find a new home, and off they go. And this little fish had done about 900 kilometres. They'd traced it on its journeys. And, I mean, there's stories of Yellow Belly doing 1,500 Ks. So our fish do some miles when they get going.
And those Namoi silver perch, which are an endangered population, aren't they? They'll travel and repopulate. So if we make sure our rivers are navigable for the fish, then they could sustainably repopulate areas all around, from your backyard all the way down to South Australia, really, couldn't they?
Yeah.
Right through the Murray-Darling system.
Theoretically, Scott, yeah.
That's amazing, isn't it? And what about the beautiful Peel right through Tamworth? You've done a lot of work there. I believe there's some happier news there than the Namoi fish kill.
Yeah, most definitely, Scott. So some good news coming out of the Peel. So after many years of negotiation and lobbying and whatever else we've had to do, we finally got the last remaining major fish passage barrier in the Peel removed. So there was an old low-level crossing slash weir right in the CBD of Tamworth here at Jury Street, and it was removed about 2 weeks ago. So I was down there doing a little happy dance on the bank and cheering and clapping profusely as the front end loader was in there digging out the last of the concrete. It was great to see. So now the Peel runs free. How good's that?
And how far could those fish now in the backyards of Tamworth go now that they can navigate the river?
They've got clear passage now. So from Chaffee Dam all the way through the Peel to its endpoint out at Carroll, which then joins into the Namoi. And the Namoi joins the Barwon-Darling system out there at Walgett. So who knows where our little fishies could get to, or who knows where some of the holidaying fishies from that direction could now come to Tamworth. They might be here in January for the country music. Who knows?
All right, if they're coming from down the Murray way or up from South Australia, make sure to check their passports. I know you know them all.
Well,
by
that's
name.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Hey, what if some of those ones that when the drought was on that got taken to Narandra, on the Murrumbidgee.
Well, they might be trying to go back. They might have made friends down there and want to head back. Who knows?
What if they come back? I mean, wouldn't that be the greatest story ever? Well, look, good on you for looking after our beautiful Murray cod and golden perch and silver perch and catfish and all those wonderful fish right through the Murray-Darling system. Some good news and some bad news. Let's hope the water authorities can work more closely with fisheries and Ausfish and the people trying to make the rivers healthy, and the farmers want that. I know you work in the agricultural industry and they're cheering you on. So let's hope they can work out water releases. You know, they'll still be releasing the water to the farmers, but just in a more controlled way so they don't kill the fish.
That's exactly what we want, you know, and then it's a win for everyone. You know, the farmers, the fish and us on the riverbanks as well.
And Mitchie, thanks for joining us again. Good luck.
No worries. Cheers, Scott.
And the crew from Ausfish doing a great job in looking after the rivers of the New England Northwest.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.